So, hey everybody, it's Tuesday, January 7th, 2014. It matters, huh? Every year is another year. This is going to be a good year for the revolution, good year for the Strategy Center, my organization. We're going into our 25th anniversary year, which is pretty cool. And it's about the third year of the second term of Barack Obama, and hopefully people are fed up enough to really rebel a lot more against this very reactionary president. And a lot of the film, for those of you who listen to Voices from the Frontlines, know that one of the things I like to do is film reviews. I did a review last year of Lincoln. We did Django. But this year, I think I'm even going to do more. So listen carefully. Today's show is called The Best Films of 2013. For those of you who get our weekly subscription or weekly announcement, you know about it. We asked some of you to be film reviewers and to write out a film review. We're going to have you go to the phones in about 5 minutes. I have started with a film review, which I'm going to talk about, which is called The Wolf of Wall Street. Then I'll talk about a couple of other films I've liked this year. Then we have several people calling in. I know who are calling in who have prepared their film reviews. Now, if you haven't prepared a film review, but you'd like to still do one, jot down even a few notes. Remember, this is a 2-minute film review. It's not a long film review. But I'm very interested in what are the films you like the most this year. Or you could take your 2 minutes to simply say, I saw 10 films this year, or 5, and these are the 5 I really like the best. Boom, 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 boom. With no elaboration, I might ask you a question. If you actually read the email that we sent you, which you can get on www.voicesfromfrontlines.com, and you're going to call in with a written review, that would be wonderful. Jesse is at the phone, so you could call her and tell her that you're going to do a review and tell her what film you're going to be about. I know that several people at the Strategy Center have prepared short film reviews, which is great. I hope they're calling in now. Jesse's on the line. All right, I'm going to start with mine, my own film review. It's called Who's Afraid of the Wolf of Wall Street, Not the Revolutionaries? In The Wolf of Wall Street, Martin Scorsese valorizes decadence with brilliant dialogue, attractive actors, and a patina of social criticism. In The Wolf, Leonardo DiCaprio, who would make leprosy sexy, was fun to watch for a while. And like Mean Streets and Goodfellas, Scorsese does a brilliant job of showing the initial attraction and fundamental debauchery of street gangsters, and in this film, small-time corporate hustlers. But unlike David Mamet's Glenn Ross, Scorsese has come not to bury capitalism, to praise it. The premise of The Wolf of Wall Street is simple enough to explain. Based on the life and book of Jordan Belfort, Wolf describes a low-life megalomaniac surrounded by a legion of sycophantic losers who make money by hustling greedy losers who think they can get rich quick. In this film, An American Hustler, and every other film about hustlers, there really are no victims because the voracious and the desperate are the yin and yang of the hustle. Belfort keeps cheating bigger and bigger suckers, builds a two-bit empire built on greed is good, doses up on coke and quaaludes, leaves his wife, who raises the most minimum qualms about his morals, for a trophy wife, Margaret Robey, has orgies on airplanes for his staff as a fringe benefit. The whole film is based on pathos envy. They're, for many, somewhat attractive compared to what? Their lives, which for them have no individual collective meaning they can explain to themselves, thanks to a ruthless system that has convinced them that the very rich who have destroyed their lives deserve their envy. I'm not sure if the orgy on the plane scene was a self-parody, but it was shocking in its asexuality. In a sad story, I read an interview with one of the actresses, quote, using the word loosely, that Scorsese cast for the scene, and she went into some detail about his demanding standards, the requirement that no one had any cosmetic surgery, how she could never say no to Martin Scorsese, overcome fear of performing nude. And then when you get to the actual scene, you can't recognize anybody, and it's about as sexual as a mortician's convention. By contrast, I just saw The End of Sexual Innocence by Mike Figgis, was made in about 1999, and the scenes of Adam and Eve with full frontal nudity by Femi Ogunbanjo and Hannah Clinton were powerfully, innocently erotic, beautifully and sexy as hell. Fortunately, I grew up in a revolutionary era where commitment, anger, dedication, humor, collective commitment, and sexuality were integral, and people joined the revolution out of attraction, not guilt. When I was 21, I went to work for the Congress of Racial Equality and was accepted into the Civil Rights Revolution that drove the larger revolution of the two decades of the 60s. At Cornell, everyone I knew was renouncing capitalism, seen as the lost lives of their parents stuck in the muck, dreary achievements of suburbia, with the beginnings of feminist criticism as well, of women trapped in suburbia. People talked about going to the Peace Corps, working on schools in the ghetto, civil rights law, going into politics to help the poor. Within a few years, we saw the treachery of the Democrats in the South and their murderous policies in the North, their murderous policies in Vietnam, and we truly hated the politics, people, and proponents of the system. We also found them profoundly unattractive, and even Leonardo DiCaprio could have not saved their ass during the 60s. For me, the movement is cool, the people the greatest, the women and men the most attractive. We were serious as hell, fun, funky, cool. It was the age of black is beautiful, say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud, my Jewish hair long held down by Sal and Vin's hair slick in Long Island, where I grew up and for a while tried to comb my hair back in the DA to meet the obligations of my Italian-Irish fellow hoods, then went to Newark, where I was subject to hot combs with Jesse Moss in Newark, as we both tried to straighten our hair, exploded into a Jufro that was very cool and again sexy. That was the age for a lot of white people for drugs, sex, and rock and roll. That for a moment lined up the movement, but in fact was easily co-opted by the system. But for us, it was revolution, sex, and soul music. We didn't think Kennedy was sexy, didn't think capitalism was sexy, but we thought we were sexy, and so did the liberals, who wished they were us when they grew up. And many jumped ship and joined us. 818-985-5735. I bet you can't do a review as good as this one. Get on the phone and try. Tell us your best film review. The actual Wall Street was almost invisible to us. We focused on the redneck politicians, the hypocritical Democrats, the sad suburban males and repressed females bound by the feminine mystique. We were way too harsh with our parents, who in retrospect did not manufacture napalm or hustle people, but rather devoted their lives to accumulation, to address the terror of the Great Depression. They were usually liberal Democrats. They rarely engaged in conspicuous consumption, but rather, they just enjoyed the house, the car, the private property that led an entire working class as well to dream of being kings of their castle, with women not in the picture as reflected in Mad Men. To agree with a counterculture, there were millions of people organizing food co-ops, teaching in inner-city schools, and having a sexual revolution that more than not was experimental, healthy, and based on some form of rebellion. There was a world to change and a world to win. The repression of that movement, the great counter-revolution in which we're still a part, began and ended with the FBI, the CIA, the police, COINTELPRO, beatings, arrests, imprisonments, and today is reflected in a full-blown police surveillance state with more police shows on TV. Still, the false promise of Barack Obama may be the last act of any popular support for a rotten system. In the 1960s, The Wolf of Wall Street could never have been made, because no one in capitalism would identify with it, and no one in the revolution wanted to see a bunch of drug-addled losers. In the 1960s, the masses were marching on Washington, the Pentagon, every military contractor, college criminal departments, taking over buildings, lunch counters, draft boards, and war contractors. Bigger creeps than Jordan Belfort were our targets, in fact. For us, creep meant committee to reelect the president, the right-wing paramilitary group that invaded the Watergate Hotel to destroy the candidacy of George McGovern, the best Democrat who ever ran for president, the most decent man, the moral opposite of Barack Obama, the arch-deceptor. In fact, we were so attractive and capitalism so unattractive in the mass consciousness that the super-rich found themselves hiding their wealth, driving unobtrusive cars, rarely boasting that greed was good or even worth living for. To the degree we saw films, it was La Guerre Finie, Sweet Sweetback's Badass Dream, Malcolm, Glory, the Spook Who Sat by the Door, and parenthesis, any listeners who can remember really great films from the 60s and 70s that they thought were the best political films, please send it to me at eric@voicesfromfrontlines.com because I want to reconstruct some of the better films we saw during the 60s and 70s. Today, we in the movement do not exist on the screen, and I must admit, rarely exist in real life as well. In Wolf, there are three plot lines, the hustlers, the hustled, and the FBI. And who wants to root for the FBI against the capitalists? Especially, it's interesting, if Leonardo DiCaprio played both J. Edgar Hoover and the hustler, we would obviously root for the hustler. At best today, capitalism shows Aaron Brockovich, a lone crusader, a lawyer, taking on the capitalists with those suffering chemical poisoning victims, hoping she win a settlement. And when she does, we're supposed to cheer when the boss gives her a check for $2 million as a cut. So much for the socialist alternative. Now, I don't know what a hopeful script looks like anymore in the real world or on the screen. John Sayles in Gopher Sisters offers at least one opportunity. Two black women, one a parole officer, one a parolee as a buddy movie, a brilliant experiment in a new genre. So we can't expect Hollywood to cover a movement that barely exists or to help us advance that which does. Until then, film criticism at least should remind us that a better world does exist today, and until more artists figure out how to make organizing and organizers come to life on the screen, we have to at least remember that we do exist. We do represent what is hopeful, attractive, and sexy for the future. So this has been Eric Mann in my review of Who's Afraid of the Wolf of Wall Street, Not the Revolutionaries. So now we're going to go to the phone. We have some listeners who have either prepared written film reviews or just going to tell us their favorite films for 2013. And please call in at 818-985-5735. You could respond to my film review of The Wolf of Wall Street. You could respond to other film reviewers, but hopefully have some film reviews of your own. So, Jesse, who do we got on the board? We have Linda from South Pasadena. Linda, how you doing?
Fine. How are you? I really welcome this opportunity to talk about the best film that I saw this year, which was Elysium.
Okay, good.
And I love this film because I normally don't like, you know, adventure, futuristic, action films, but this one was many things all at once. First of all, it is set in the future, but it's in the future that seems to be partially of the time that we're living now, so we can identify. I could identify many circumstances with what I'm living now as a working person and a aware person. And basically, it's about when our civilization, so to speak, has evolved into living on two planets, and one is the planet Earth, and the other is a space station, which is called Elysium. And it's divided in the people who are left on Earth are the rest of us, and the people that live up on Elysium are the power elite and all of the accoutrements of society and civilization that we see them living in now, you know, the wonderful homes and the everything clean, pristine, and beautiful.
And what did you like, and what did you see as the cutting edge of the film?
Well, and so what got me was that it was an action film. It had a lot of drama. It had comedy. It had a lot of people that I could relate to and see in my everyday life who were acting in it. It had Damon. Matt Damon is just a working guy, and so you see him living throughout his workaday, and he gets into an accident, a work accident, a terrible work accident, because of some very typical boss attitudes about workers, and he didn't have any, you know, there was very low safety monitoring and stuff like that. And so as a result of that, he gets a medical condition in which he's told by the robotic health system, you're going to die in 5 days, take these pills.
Yeah, well, this is great. The plot line is good. Tell us about, this is your last point. What did you think is the main political point that you liked about the film?
Political point, I think?
Or anything.
It reflects what, in a very stark way, I mean, in a clear way. I wouldn't say it was dark because it was actually funny. What we're living in now, for example, and he decides that he has to go get.
Okay, Linda, I'm going to let you go now. Okay, Linda, you did great. Thank you very much for calling in about Elysium. And we're going to get some other reviews. 818-985-5735. So far, we now have Michelle from Santa Clarita, and she's going to review Walter Mitty. Come on, folks. 818-985-5735. Call with the film you like the most this year that you want to tell our listeners about. Okay, Michelle, talk to us.
Hi. So I just recently saw Secret Life of Walter Mitty, and it's probably one of the best movies I've seen ever, I would say. I didn't read the short story, but basically starts out with this guy who, you know, he's been working at Life magazine for about 16 years. You know, he hasn't been promoted. He still works, you know, in the basement type area. And he just really puts a lot of hard work into what he does, and it goes unnoticed. And so Life magazine, they're moving to an online, you know, an online change. They're not going to print the magazine anymore. And the famous photographer, Sean Johnson, who Sean Penn's character plays, you know, he has a close relationship with the negative photo analyzer, which is Ben Stiller's character, Walter Mitty. And he thanks him for all the hard work he's done, and he said number 25 is by far the best photo ever. And the big CEOs of the company, the people who run it, are, you know, they're trying to get it from him, and the photo didn't come in. And so Walter Mitty, you know, just is important to him, and in turn he ends up going on this journey to try and find it. And it just ends up taking him across the world to try and find this photographer. And, you know, he connects with his mother and his sister, and his mom finds, like, all of his old traveling stuff and his backpacking kid that he was going to go to Europe with that he didn't end up doing. And, you know, the character transformation is probably the most amazing part in the whole story, because he goes from this guy who has no confidence, who's daydreaming half the time, not even really listening to what people are saying, to a guy who has courage and strength. And, you know, this woman that he liked at his office, he gets the courage to talk to her, and he actually has, like, a daydream about her that gives him the strength to, like, hop in this helicopter ride with this crazy guy that he meets in Greenland to chase this photographer. And, you know, he's skating down a huge mountain, and he's running from a volcanic eruption. And I think my favorite part of the whole movie was how in the beginning he would have these crazy daydreams about, like, fighting people, but then it actually turns into reality of all these crazy scenarios that are happening to him. He ends up getting, like, jumping out of a helicopter into water and getting almost attacked by a shark. And meanwhile, he was on eHarmony.com trying to connect with women, and he had nothing to say about himself. And then he's like, well, now I guess I can say that, you know, I skated down a mountain and I ran from a volcano and got in a fight with a shark. So it just, the whole movie is just really an amazing character transformation. And it's all based off of having really good morals and just, you know, being a person who's frightened of life and then realizing that living life is what you're supposed to do. And it really, really hit home with me. And everyone I've talked to said it was an amazing film.
Well, thanks. They loved it. Thanks, yeah. A lot. I mean, my mom watched, you know, was a big film buff. That film was made originally in the 30s or 40s.
Right. That's what I heard.
Right. And so I heard about The Secret Life of Walter Mitty. My mom used a lot of analogies, and, you know, it was sort of like a private person who didn't bust out, and shy person who really had great things inside of themselves. So
right.
Do you consider yourself a shy person?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I just think there's a lot of people in this world who, you know, they're afraid to just live their life. And, you know, I know a lot of them, you know, and I just think the whole point of him realizing that he always had these dreams inside of him and that he was always capable of it was just amazing. And the fact that at the end of the movie, the final cover, you know, I don't want to give it away, but I mean, it's just really, it's a really touching story, and the way they put it together is amazing.
Did it make you feel more encouraged about your own self?
Oh yeah. I mean, I've always wanted to travel, but just seeing that movie, it just reinforced all of my ideas and my dreams. And it's a feel good movie for sure. I mean, on any level for anyone, I would say.
Well, thanks for calling in, and why don't you sit down and make a list of two or three things you want to do based on the movie, and at least do one of them.
Yeah, absolutely. I will.
All right. Take good care, and thank you so much for calling. This is great. Okay. I'm going to go to Channing from LA, and what was the name of the film you wanted to do? It's an independent film. Come on, Channing. Tell us about the film you watched and why you think it's important.
Hey, so how are you doing, Eric?
Good, Channing. Martinez, how are you doing?
I'm doing really good. So we went to a festival, me and a friend, Judy, the South African Arts Festival, and we saw some of the films there from filmmakers from South Africa. And this film is called Othello Burning. So if you think about the actual, the old story of Othello, like him being friends with someone, right, and being portrayed by someone, this film takes that concept and applies it to things that are happening in actual life. And so the film is actually set in 1989, and it's set in Lamontville, South Africa, during the apartheid African government. So it's a great film about it shows the material conditions of South African villages, right? And showing a lot about, it shows a lot of what happens in the village in terms of, like, people turning against each other, right? And the apartheid government having their hands in almost every aspect of life, right? And the film is actually about this friend who is basically, if you looked at it, he's in this situation. It's very, like, about South Africa, but it's also very versatile to be seen in today's society. It's about a young man who is in a community that's doing really bad, and it's under oppressive society, right? And he actually wants to get out. So the film shows him attempting to get out, and one way is through surfing and meeting a friend that has many connections. And there's like a lot of conflict about, and we find out that the apartheid government is involved in more ways than we think.
Is the protagonist a black African?
The protagonist is a black African. In fact, everyone in the film, with respect to like three people, are black, except for one person who is a white guy who is not. He is what I would say is a liberal white man. I wouldn't say that he was in apartheid, in the main organization talking about let's end apartheid, but he was what one might consider a forward-thinking white man who was liberal and actually believed in justice for black folks and did not agree with apartheid.
To the degree, it doesn't have to be, but did the film have a so-called message or a political line or a point? Films don't have to be didactic, I'm not arguing that. But if it was trying to make a point, what do you think, what was the point that impacted you? Like, why did you call us now and say, I want, like, if somebody said to you, Channing, so I get it, but why should I go see this film?
For me, what was most important about the film was that of all of the films that I've seen that are narrative, that depict South Africa during apartheid, I think this film does it the best of really showing on the ground, like, material conditions of people that, and what people actually had to go through, right? And actual situations. And so the story itself, for me, is like one of those actual situations where it seems like it's disconnected and it's just some drama, but we realize in the end that this was all motivated by the apartheid government, and the government literally trying to be involved in every aspect of people's lives and trying to ruin people's lives. There's that, and it also gets confusing because we see people in the same community turning against other people in the community. So there's a mixed message of actually seeing what the apartheid government is doing and how do we stand up against and stand for unity in our communities.
Well, I think one of the things, Othello Burning, is that one of the things we know is that the ruling class knows how to rule. And one of the things they do is they have a science of division, a science of causing conflict within communities, you know, picking apart every racial and ethnic difference, every economic difference, every religious difference, personal ambitions, you know, and I think it sounds like it describes the totalitarian nature of apartheid, not that it was just brutal, but as you seem to indicate, it permeated every aspect of South African society.
Yeah, I mean, when we're talking about today about surveillance of the movement, like one of the demands of the Fight for the Soul of the City is surveillance of the movement. Like that film, we find out people that were working for the government that we were like, oh boy, who seemed like perfect people that were actually working in the community, right? I think you're absolutely right.
Well, I think that's a good thing. Like Channing is talking about something that the Strategy Center has called Fight for the Soul of the Cities, and you know, our demands are no cars in L.A. and free public transportation, open borders, amnesty for immigrants, free the U.S. 2.5 million, and no U.S. drones, and stop the police and the surveillance state. And I think we see today that the police and surveillance state are very deep in our lives. So Othello Burning, how do we find it? Where did you see it again?
I saw it at the South African Arts Festival, but I just went to their website, and it gives you more information about the release of the movie, and I believe there's also a digital copy.
Wonderful. Folks, because, I mean, one of the things about these small experimental films is you've got to go out and find them.
Yeah.
So tell you the name of the website again, Channing, please.
So it's literally the name of the movie. It's othelloburning.com.
Right.
So that's othelloburning.com.
Okay, thank you so much. We're going to come to our next caller. So our next film reviewer, this is the best films of 2013, Bianca, and you're going to talk about Harvest of Empire. Hi, Bianca.
Hi, Eric.
Tell us about the film. Where'd you see it? Why do you like it?
I saw the film. I got a video from it, and it talks about the immigration starting from the 1500s, when the United States and Mexico were creating treaties, if you would call that, and it traces how the immigration has always increased whenever there's economic growth in the United States, and it's demanding workers at a low wage. You know, it's a movie that has really opened up my eyes on immigration. I'm Mexican, but not only from the Mexicans that have immigrated to America, but also all the other Latino countries that have been pretty much pushed to come to the United States and be subjugated to working conditions and discrimination based on their language and the poor access to equality.
Is this based on Juan Gonzalez's book?
Yes, it is. It is based on Juan Gonzalez's book from Democracy Now, and it's a very rich documentary that was from the book. It came to be a documentary, and it is something that I have been able to show my children and be able to share with others. It has really opened up my eyes and understanding better the history of immigration and where we're at right now and all the changes that are happening across the country with the immigration reform bill, also what's happening in Arizona, Maricopa County, and all the southern states, and how it's changing from, the discrimination hasn't really changed, but it's changing depending on the economics. So right now we're having a financial hardship on everyone, and so we're at the bottom of the totem pole, and we're being attacked.
Bianca Sadi is active at the Bus Riders Union Planning Committee. When you think about the demands and Fight for the Soul of the Cities about open borders and amnesty, what do you think the relationship is between the video you saw and those demands?
The relationship is that we have lots of corporate interest and lots of money behind keeping borders. It's a money-making business for prisons, for contractors, creating more a militarized border. So the connection there is that they want to keep us they want to create this fence, and they want to create a stronger immigration bills that limit us from having people come in legally, because it creates more money for the system to hold us back, for the corporations. And in return, it's really hurting not only families right now that are being deported and separated at the rate of close to 2 million already under Obama administration, and it's going to continue to devastate our communities. It's breaking down our communities, and it's showing how there's so much push for this image of terrorists. And under that guise, you know, we're really are destroying our Latino community. It is a population that is threatening a lot of the Republicans, because we will have a lot of voting say, and they're preventing us step by step. Open borders doesn't create a caste system, and it shouldn't be. We are all one here in this world, and we need to see it as that. We're not any less because we live on the other side of San Diego or down in Central America.
Well, thanks, Bianca. That was good. I'm really glad you called with your film review. And say the name of the film again.
The film is Harvest of Empire.
And how do you get the DVD? How do you get the DVD?
Well, I got it through a pledge that I did on KPFK and Democracy Now!, but you can also order it online at Amazon, and you can look it up on the Internet.
Thanks a lot. Take good care of yourself.
Thank you.
This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines. We're doing our best films of 2013. Our next film reviewer is Ron from Los Angeles. He's going to talk to us about Hunger Games 2. Hey, Ron, how you doing?
Hey, Eric, how are you doing today?
I'm good. Why do you like this film?
I like it because it's one of the first films that I've seen that's a major Hollywood picture that really deals with the idea of pushing back against the government and really looking at a really oppressive government and people's absolute necessity to fight back against it. So it was political in that sense, but, like, for instance, there wasn't necessarily a political line as to why people were fighting other than injustice, right? And so basically this movie picks up at the exact end of the first film, which is the main character has just come from the first Hunger Games, where she actually defied the government. Instead of there should only be one victor, but she finagled it so that her and her a friend of hers were both able to win the Hunger Games. And so from that really disrupts the system. Because the idea is that this whole system is set up for control. They show you the Hunger Games every year so they can control you. And they, you know, they're very strict and very rigid about these rules inside the Hunger Games so that they can control the populace. And so by going outside of the norm of what was supposed to go on in the Hunger Games, what the main character really did was make a direct challenge to the power structure. And it was so interesting to see for me as the story developed that it really became this power struggle between this one individual and the entire power structure because of what this individual represented. This individual represented that people could actually think outside of could think outside of the system. And so that was really one of the reasons that impacted me. I always say that the main character, Katniss, is a reluctant revolutionary. She doesn't want to be involved. She doesn't necessarily, you know, want to fight for the cause of the people, but because of her current situation, her wanting to help out her family immediately, she ends up becoming this symbol for something much bigger than herself. And as she tours across the country being a victor for the Hunger Games, you really get to see how her personal story has impacted so many people. So that was one of the reasons that I thought that the film was just great. And not only
also,
that.
Also, isn't it true, though, that Leanne was saying to me that the film also shows that there is a clandestine organization going on, that while she is sort of the mass figure or the reluctant revolutionary, Philip Seymour Hoffman and others are actually building a cadre organization inside of the dictatorship. Is that true?
It is. And one of the great things is that you actually get to see that very little. So it's not until you reach a certain point in the movie do you really understand that there is a much larger organization. You hear about this resistance throughout the entire film, and it's not until you get reach a certain point in the film where you start to make connections around just how big this resistance is and just how much of an impact that they play and just how important the role of having, like you said, a clandestine organization inside the larger power structure really is.
And it's also, I think, another issue is, you know, we're not used to women superheroes, and in this case, sort of women leading revolutions.
It's true. It's one of the things that I also enjoyed about it is that the main character is a very young woman, right? And so you're seeing not only just a very strong female character, but it's also very much speaking to young women who could be going through, and the struggles that it brings out for this young woman are just so many and varied, right? It talks about her dealing with patriarchy in a lot of ways, talking about who she should and shouldn't be with, why she should and shouldn't be with them, and on top of that, having to deal with this whole other crazy situation that's going on in her life. And so, yeah, I think it was also very impactful to have a heroine as a character or a female hero.
Thanks, Ron. That was great to have you on the show. So you see, folks, The Hunger Games, you didn't know, was a subversive revolutionary film. And also those people had to work out hard to get those bodies. So get to the gym tomorrow morning. Ron, thanks for being on Voices from the Frontlines. We're now going to go to Crystal, who's going to talk to us about 12 Years a Slave. So, hey, Crystal from L.A., how you doing?
I'm good.
Are you in a relationship to the producer of the show?
Oh, you know, she's a wonderful friend of mine.
Good, good. Well, go ahead.
Oh, one of the films, I would say one of the most powerful films I've seen this year was 12 Years a Slave. And it's based on a real-life story of Solomon Northrup, who was a free man who was kidnapped and sold into slavery in the South. And I want to make sure I pronounce his name right. Chiwetel Ejiofor, who's the lead actor. He takes us through all these stages of this horror, from disbelief to desperation to a sense of degradation, and finally, to a sense of resignation. And I've seen depictions of American slavery on screen before. I mean, I'm old enough to remember watching Roots with my family. And what I found striking about this one, this film, was not the beatings or the use of the N-word, but it was the depiction of the casual cruelty and the dehumanization of an entire people. I mean, Solomon's an outsider. He was sold into slavery as an adult. And I think that's what helps him serve as the audience's window into this deeply ingrained system whose only purpose is to justify these acts that reduce a human being to something that could be bought, sold, or killed without conscience. And when I left the film, one of the things that haunted me was the other part of the story, the story they didn't tell, about the people who were kidnapped and sold whose names we'll never learn, or the people that Solomon left behind when he regained his freedom. And these people were born into bondage but had just as much right as he did to live a life of dignity and freedom. And that's the part of the film that haunted me after I'd left.
Well, I think that's great. I mean, one of the things that I haven't seen the film yet, as I was telling you, that was it painful to watch?
Yes. Some parts of it, you almost wanted to look away. And I think, for me, I had read the story of Solomon Northrup when I was much younger. And I think the only reason I was able to get through it as well as I did was because I knew he was not going to die there. I knew that he was going to be freed, you know. Spoiler alert, but yes, I knew he was going to be freed, and that's the only thing that even made it marginally bearable, which is why I think, as I said, the other part, the other people around him haunted me even more.
Well, I think you're right about is that, you know, when, you know, they always say, well, you know, the system can only understand one person or two people, you have to personalize the struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with that argument is it's not that we don't want to take one or two or three or four lives and bring it to the public's awareness. But what you said, Crystal, I thought was great, is what that shows is the other 4 million lives that you haven't shown are the same people. You know, each one is its own story. So you see Fruitvale Station, mm-hmm. and you see one person, Oscar Grant, but do you understand that right next to him and right behind him and right across from him were the other Oscar Grants, or do people come back and say, wow, what a courageous dude?
Right. Right. And when you see the mechanics of how they steal him, you know that this is not the first time or the only time that this happened. And this was not just a random act of violence against one person. This was a systemic evil that was perpetrated against a lot of people who probably died you know, and, you know, on the side of the road somewhere. And it's the part of American history that people, a lot of people, want to sweep under the rug and don't want to talk about. They're trying, there have been attempts to even take slavery as a cause of the Civil War out of history books.
They thank you, Crystal. This is great. It looks like we got more people.
Oh.
Crystal, thank you so much. Now, listen, folks, I'm going to hold you to 2 minutes because we've got Marlene, Manuel, Laura, Anne-Marie. Bill, you're going to tell us about Philomena.
Right.
And thank you for holding on.
That's okay, Eric. It's a good show. I was raised a Catholic until I left when I was 15 years old. But I realized I was an atheist. But I think this is a powerful film. It's about, it takes place during that time, I guess up until the late 70s, when Catholic girls who became pregnant were put into these convents and had to work as slaves in a laundry for at least 4 years. And their babies were sold to Americans, or wealthy Americans who were looking for a child to adopt. And this is about a woman's search for her son who was taken forcibly away from her when she was, when she had gotten pregnant, worked in a convent, and she'd spent her life looking for the child. And they told her the child had died, and they told, when the child came back to look for her as an adult, they told him his mother had died. And I just love the film because it shows the Catholic Church basically for what it is, exploiting poor people like they've done since the time of Constantine. And I think everybody should see it who's not brainwashed. Maybe the people who are brainwashed should see it, too.
Well, I'm going to see it. So Judi Dench was the lead. Who's the other lead?
He's a British, a big comedian in Britain named Steve Coogan. He's not very well known in this country, but he was also one of the writers of the film.
Well, thank you so much. I want to see that. And, of course, with the new Pope raising more criticism of the Catholic Church, this might be a really good time to do it. Bill, thank you for waiting, and thanks for... No, seriously, I'm going to go see that. Marlene from North Hollywood, Walter Mitty, talk to us.
Wow, listen to all these great KPFK listeners.
Yes, they,
really,
they are.
I'm telling you, they're on the money for their comments. I just want to say about Walter Mitty that I thought the uplifting thing about that movie was that the hero was the working person, the working man. That was the hero. And the corporate guys, I mean, they were portrayed for who they are, which is, I mean, certainly probably maybe not all of them, but so many who don't care about, you know, the people. So I just wanted to say that about Walter Mitty. And I wanted to say Philomena was great. And I wanted to say Frontline tonight is to take down a traitor, to watch that. And the other thing I want to ask you, Eric, is I was just curious when the woman was talking about Elysium, I was curious why you cut her off and yet the next person, which was a younger voice, you let her go on. And I was really taken aback by that.
Well, I'll say that in each interview, I try to ask the person if there is a point. And if I think, first of all, everybody here got at least 3 or 4 minutes. And as a host, you sort of move a story along and then you don't cut people off. You simply end the interview because you came in 2 or 3 minutes. You made your point. Plus, you scored a good criticism of me. So you got right to the point. So just trust me, I think on any other radio show, we have a lot of listeners, and
no,
sometimes...
I know that.
So thank you. You made the point.
I could feel your impatience. Could I just say?
Yeah.
I could feel your impatience before she got disconnected. I guess I'm off the air.
No, that's okay. I think the thing to say is sometimes if I'm asking a person, what is the point? And if the point keeps being the repeating the plot line of the show...
Uh-huh.
Then at a point, I don't want to hear the movie. I want to hear the film review. So, you made the point, and I'm going to move on. Manuel from East L.A., a band called Death.
Yeah, I want to talk about an incredible documentary I just saw. It's called A Band Called Death, which was released in 2012. It's about an all-black band called Death from the early 1970s whose music and sound was denied for over 40 years to the world because of a sad combination of its own morbid band name called Death, a hard politicized punk music that was before its time, and of course the reality of stereotyping black music and musician as solely as funk and soul, and not really crediting rock and roll as actually black music. The documentary, you know, documents the life of the Hackney brothers, David, Bobby, and Dennis from Detroit, Michigan. imagine David Hackney, who in some ways is part Jimi Hendrix, Curtis Mayfield, and Joey Ramone all wrapped up into one, with his life spinning out of control and alienation, just like his hometown of Detroit, Michigan, a haven of excessive U.S. capitalism, and as we see it today, the disasters that we're seeing today in Detroit, a place of social and economic freedom for millions of blacks escaping Jim Crow South, and yet facing miserable and racist conditions at work. You know, in many ways, this movie is in the tradition of the breakthrough hit, The Searching for Sugar Man, comes another great documentary about passion, commitment, and humbleness. With songs like You're a Prisoner, Keep on Knocking, and Politicians My Eyes, you can hear the anguish, the hope, the despair, the anger, and vision. Go see it. You know, the word death for David Hackney was not morbid Christian death, but a death that transcends our mortal bodies. This movie delivers with a beautiful film about family, specifically the black family, and its role of survival and collective expression. The dreamers come and sometimes can't handle a material deteriorating world, but who keep a vision and hope that redemption and legacy can be achieved.
Dang, dude, that's brilliantly written and brilliantly delivered. Got to have you on more often. Thanks, Manuel. Hey, Lauda from Long Beach, we got to move, but I want to get you on, and I want to get on Anne Marie. So if I cut you off, tell us about your film. Lauda, you still on from Long Beach? Okay, we're moving to Anne Marie. You get the last word from Miracle Mile.
Yes, Eric, I want to tell you and your listeners about a very wonderful, small, independent movie I saw this summer called Ain't Them Bodies Saints. Kind of a strange title. The two reasons why people should seek this out and really try to see it, number one, the cinematography is magnificent. This is one low-budget indie movie that does not look like it was shot for TV. And it just reminded me all over again why film is, or at least why film should be, a visual medium. And the second reason they should see it is, even though this director takes a very small story about some young people who are in love and in trouble on both sides of the law in rural Texas in the recent past, he uses that small story to make some very big points about why guilt and innocence are a matter of degree. He doesn't tell you how to think. He doesn't tell you who's the good guy and the bad guy. He shows you people's behavior, and then you have to make up your own mind. It's
Well, thank you so much. I just got the get off the air sign. Tell
Thanks,
us
Eric.
One more time the name of the film, please.
The name of the film is Ain't Them Bodies Saints.
Ain't Them Bodies Saints. We're going to go on Google and find that. Hey, everybody, this has been beautiful. This is what I wanted, which is to get our listeners to become film reviewers. If you like my review of Who's Afraid of the Wolf of Wall Street, it should be up on our website in about 2 days and probably be published somewhere else. I want to thank everybody at KPFK. Take good care, and we'll see you next week.